Today in Studio 360, Lena Dunham.
I think that I may be the voice of my generation, or at least a voice of a generation.
The star of the new HBO series Girls is also its creator, writer, and director. And it's like no other show out there. As a kid, Dunham did her homework to make sure of that.
A lot of parents are like, you've got an hour at night. I would come home and watch like 8 hours of television. And I don't consider that to be a waste of time.
And who's the most happening Nigerian singer-songwriter right now? It has to be Nneka. The state of madness is where I find myself. Plus, we'll announce the three winners of our Significant Objects Fiction Contest. I'm Kurt Anderson. All that and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Studio 360 is supported by the Vilcek Foundation, dedicated to raising awareness of immigrant contributions to the arts and sciences, congratulating the winners of the 2012 Vilcek Prizes, Carlos Bustamante in biomedical science, and Mikhail Baryshnikov in dance. More info at vilcek.org.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Later in the show, the finale of our Significant Objects story competition. We asked you to write short fiction about real objects that we bought at a thrift store. Hundreds of you shared your stories with us, including 11-year-old Marley Duncan.
All that lay there was a small doll, slightly disfigured. The doll looked up at her with one rather large eye, loosely stitched, and one quite small in comparison. More of a dot, really. A jagged mouth ran across the face, giving Daphelia a mangled smile.
We'll announce the winners of the contest later this hour. But first, we're going to talk about the movies. Last year, of the 10 films that sold the most tickets, 8 were rated PG-13. Studios fight hard to avoid R ratings, especially for their big, expensive movies, because they desperately want as many young patrons as possible. So when the new documentary Bully about school bullying was assigned an R rating, its extremely passionate distributor, Harvey Weinstein, launched a big public campaign to have the rating ratcheted back. Here is a clip from the film.
They punch me, strangle me, take things from me. Sit on me.
Give it to him hard!
He's not safe on that bus.
Weinstein got the PG-13 rating after agreeing to cut just a couple of bits of rough language from the film. And so, once again, everybody is arguing about the peculiar, opaque world of Hollywood's self-censorship system. Every movie's rating is decided by an anonymous panel of people, supposedly regular people, whom the Motion Picture Association refers to only as parents. Which means, theoretically, I could join. Here with me to figure this out is the filmmaker Kirby Dick. His 2006 documentary, This Film Is Not Yet Rated, is an investigation of how the rating system works. Kirby, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So this documentary, Bully, at first got an R rating because the real children depicted in it used too many four-letter words on camera. But the other night, I saw in a movie, a guy being slowly cut in half with a giant cleaver and a raccoon eating a human heart, and that movie was rated PG-13. Does anybody know what the rules are? Is there a set of rules?
Well, actually, there are really no written rules. Actually, there's only one as far as I know, which is the use of the F word. If you use the F word once in a non-sexual context, you can get a PG-13 rating. But if you use it in a sexual context or use it twice in a non-sexual context, then you get an R rating.
PG-13 allows pretty grisly violence and murder to be depicted. What distinguishes these days a PG-13 movie from an R movie in terms of depiction of sex?
that is one of the very vague areas on this, is that it's sort of, this is what I feel the rating should be. It's not being done at all with any kind of transparency, and it's not being done with any kind of guidelines.
Has it always operated more or less in this not quasi non-independent fashion?
It used to be a little more transparent in this 70s and early 80s, but that, you know, one of its hallmarks now is that no one really knows what's going on. Everything goes on behind closed doors, which is astounding that an industry would be able to self-regulate, you know, in the 21st century. I don't think that the six major studios, which control 90% of the film business, should be rating films, the entire industry's films, both their own films, which is fine if they want to apply ratings to those, but also their competitors' films. That puts them in a position to rate their films less harshly and allow their films to make more money and rate their competitors' films more harshly, which they do repeatedly.
Which brings in a question of whether such a system, especially in the internet age and the cable TV age, needs to exist at all.
What should be done is they should have and it's not hard to do, they should really have a break it out by category, sex, violence, profanity, drug use, mature content, and very very precisely but quickly list what's in each of those categories so parents can decide. Right now they have very vague categories, and the reason for that is they want to make sure that they can get their films to be PG-13. And the vaguer the categories are, the more they are able sort of to fudge the ratings and push their films into a PG-13 category.
And although, as you say, the system is meant to guide parents, as if parents of teenagers really have much control over what their 16-year-olds will see. But the crux is really PG-13 versus R, because once it's an R, then theaters are obliged not to let kids under 17 in.
Exactly.
Is there a good example of films where of non-big Hollywood studio films that are rated more harshly versus a studio film that is cut slack?
Dark Knight received a PG-13.
That was the Batman film with Heath Ledger.
Right, which has, you know, quite a significant amount of violence in it.
Do you want to know why I use a knife? Guns are too quick. You can't savor all the little emotions.
And again, I mean, it's a good film. I mean, I'm not saying the film shouldn't be made, but parents were not aware of the level of violence in that film. And there was really no effort made on the part of the studio or the ratings board to warn parents with regards to that film. It's a real double standard. I mean, the reason these ratings board does not rate films as harshly because of violence is because that's where most of the films that are PG-13 or violent are making a lot of money.
And conversely, are there independent films that get an R rating that you believe if they were studio films would be PG-13?
I mean, one example that comes to mind is John Waters' A Dirty Shame. It received an NC-17, even though it really should have received an R rating. There's essentially no real nudity in the film whatsoever, nothing compared to the kind of American Pie sort of nudity that, and all the other sort of raunchy R-rated comedies that you see that have been out in the last 10 years.
Kirby, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Kirby Dick is the director of the 2006 documentary This Film Is Not Yet Rated. His new film, The Invisible War, about rape in the military, will be released in June. So what do you think? What's the best way for movies to be rated? Or should they be rated at all? Tell us at studio360.org. Coming up, Lena Dunham is the wunderkindiest wunderkind of 2012. She's the creator and star of the new HBO series Girls. But growing up, she never got the starring role, or even a second lead.
I always wanted to be in school plays and was always cast as like a bouncing ball or a third woman in waiting. I never had whatever quality gives you the part of, you know, Eponine in a condensed production of Les Mis. I did not have that quality.
Lena Dunham is ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. TV shows about single young women in New York City have been around for decades, from That Girl in the late 60s, Sex and the City at the turn of the century, Gossip Girl, Two Broke Girls. Some of them go for super glamour, some for the purely goofy, but I can't think of any that have really tried to be super realistic. This weekend, a remarkable new series called Girls premieres on HBO. It's smart and funny, a lot about sex, but this is not some glam fairy tale.
Hey, a little bird told me that you are getting an STD test. Fun. Do you really think that sounds like a lot of fun? I mean, like, just to get to have sex and then have a test about it?
This thing asks you if you wear a seatbelt and if you operate machinery.
Well, those are important things. If you're going to have a baby, you need to wear a seatbelt and stop operating machinery. She's obsessed with getting AIDS. She's thought she was going to have it since she was like 10 years old. So that's what this is about.
I don't have an obsessive fear of AIDS. I have obsessive fear of HIV that turns into AIDS. I'm not a fool.
Well, you don't have HIV. You just don't. It's not that easy to contract.
It's like really not that hard to contract either, though. Like, haven't you seen Rent?
Please, I've seen it like 12 times. It's basically why I moved to New York.
That's a scene from the new series Girls on HBO. The show's creator, director, writer, and star is a 25-year-old lifelong New Yorker named Lena Dunham, and she's here with me now. Lena, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much for having me, Kurt.
And congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
This is a good show.
Oh, I'm so glad you think so. And and you're slightly outside what I initially imagined as the Target demo. And
what? Girls has a similar premise in the log line sense to your HBO predecessor, Sex and the City. But it's almost the antithesis of that show. There are no beautiful shots of Manhattan and no cute romantic Cinderella qualities. And I expect you'll probably never have a shopping montage in the show.
No, it'd be like a montage of like shopping in your like corner Spanish Mart and like trying to find the ingredients to make a last minute souffle.
In your commitment to realism. And when there's sex, of which there's not a little, it tends to be awkward and unsatisfying. When you conceived of this show, and as you were writing it and making it, did you think, not Sex and the City, not Sex and the City?
You know, I wasn't thinking about it as anti, and I wasn't thinking about it as filling the slot. I was really thinking about it as what I wanted to watch on TV at that very moment. You know, it was funny because at first the show has four female characters, and I wrote it to have three and sort of an ex, like, you know, the woman who's like not quite in the posse, like the Phyllis, if we're going by Mary Tyler Moore references, she's like your kooky downstairs.
She got her
neighbor.
Own show.
It's true, but she didn't start out. It's true. Phyllis, it's not quite a correct analogy. I'm trying to think, like on Friends, it's like Phoebe's evil twin, who was also on Mad About You. You know, just a fringier character. And but ultimately, and that character was Shoshana, played by Zasha Mamet, who you heard in the clip before asking me politely if I was excited for my STD test. And she was so great that it was suddenly like, up. I guess we've got four women. And I thought, could I set this outside New York? Like, if I put it in Boston, will it be less obvious?
You're 25. You're a New York writer. You star in this show, your character, as a 25, let's
She's
say.
24. I'm 25. So we're
there you go,
it's
very
really
different.
Hard to play her.
As a New York writer. And your feature film, Tiny Furniture, was also about this young, aspiring New York writer and starred your actual mother and sister.
Mm-hmm.
Write what you know. Okay. But to write what you know so in such apparent, close, autobiographical proximity to who you are,
yeah.
Does that give you any pause?
You know, I went into it with very little thought, just kind of following my artistic instincts, which is sort of what I've always been taught to do by my parents, by my teachers in high school, is just sort of like, you know, go with it. Go with what you're feeling. And so I didn't really think about the drawbacks of that. I do. At the same time, I am totally aware that, like, when someone doesn't like my movie or doesn't like my show, it's not easy for me to distance. It's not
they
like,
don't like you.
Yeah. It's not like, you know, well, I cast the wrong actress. It's like, it's really yeah. like you are getting a full dose of me. And if it's not, it's funny. Like, I dated someone who was like, I like you a lot. I'm not sure how I feel about your movie. And I was like, that is really, that's like, you know, I'm really into you, but like, I think that your face is going to be hard for me to deal with. It's a really, that's not a good analogy, but it's a, their two things are very indistinguishable. And, you know, of course, there are moments where I wish I had a little more cover. I never thought of myself as an actor. I always wanted to be in school plays and was always cast as like a bouncing ball or a third woman in waiting. I never had whatever quality gives you the part of, you know, Eponine in a condensed production of Les Mis. I did not have that quality. And so one of the reasons I loved writing is because I was like, I can sit down in my room and I can do this alone. And this is, and one of the reasons I started out making tiny, low-budget films and was in some ways scared to make the budget leap was because I loved what was possible. And so it didn't really seem like anyone was very, I'm the only person who's ever really, with a couple exceptions, been interested in casting myself. But
And were you either in the film, and I guess there were budgetary considerations there, but now you're at HBO, you've got all the money in the world. Did you ever think, oh, I should get some Zooey Deschanel type to play this character?
Totally. I had those moments where I was like, am I insane for not getting a Zooey Deschanel type? But, you know, because there's a certain amount of audacity you feel when you're going, oh, yeah, no, I think it's a good idea for me to be the center of a TV show. Like, it's hard to sort of balance that with my general feeling of modesty. Like, to be the same person who has trouble taking compliments and also thinks that they should be on camera for an entire 90 minutes, it's a weird disconnect. But
well, no, the best description of writers I've ever heard is that they are shy megalomaniacs. You seem to be expressing the megalomania a little bit more than most writers.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate, maybe that's accurate.
And I guess bravely, don't mind showing yourself in unflattering ways as a person. You're physically, that seems perfectly okay with you.
Yeah, it's not something that's ever made me uncomfortable. In fact, sometimes I have to pull myself back from my instinct to kind of overly humiliate my character. Like, those are the scenes that are the most fun to play. Those are the scenes that are the most fun to write. And I have to make sure that I keep the sort of balance of the fact that life is not an endless series. Life is not being tarred, then feathered, then covered in mud, then put in a, you know, ketchup shower. Life is those moments and other moments. But yeah, the nudity thing, for some reason, I has never been an issue for me.
And as you've now made a movie with lots of fake sex direction and fake sex acting, and now you're making a show, do you get better at that?
At fake sex?
Just skillful, just in terms of the craft of that.
I would say that gets easier to block those scenes. I was always really awkward about just like getting down to it and block. Like, I'd always be like, well, you know, whatever makes you comfortable. Now I'm just kind of like, you sit over there, I'll sit over here, let's touch.
So you're just like a hard-bitten porn director.
Yeah, exactly. But it gets, and also like I am really, I've never done a sex scene with a guy who wasn't my friend and who I wasn't, I know this sounds creepy, but like Adam Driver's become such a good friend that I told someone the other day.
He plays your boyfriend in the
show. He plays my boyfriend in the show that I told someone it was like having sex with your brother in the not creepy way, if that's possible.
I guess you're pioneering, even semantically. During the last quarter of the 20th century, young women weren't supposed to be called girls. That was sort of not what you called them anymore. That was some remnant of the Mad Men age.
It's like you're not supposed to say actress anymore, I just learned.
I know, and I can't bring myself to do that. But now girls, as in the title of your show, is the hep obligatory thing. Is that meaningful or is that just fashion change?
You know, I think that it has to do with, like, you know how we're always hearing like 60s the new 40, 20s the new 10 or whatever. I think that
20 is the new 10. That's interesting.
And girls are the new women. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's something kind of flattering and sweet about being called a girl, something kind of dismissive. I was interested in it as a title. Judd Apatow actually came up with the title.
Who's my overlord? Producer?
Yeah. And he's great, and he was able to sort of come up with this title that to me was really fun because it was like there were so many reads on it. Like, you know, not a girl, not yet a woman. I love the idea that like we'd have a show in 5 years where it's called Girls and someone's pushing a stroller. Like, I'm interested in the way that they can't identify as women quite yet. And I had this experience last summer where I was out in the street using my cell phone at night and this 17-year-old girl was crying and she said, my cell phone's dead and I need to call my mom. Can I borrow yours? And I was like, of course. A crying 17-year-old gets me just as much as the next girl. And she was on the phone with her mom and she said, no, mom, I don't know whose phone it is. Just some lady. And she called me a lady and I was like, I'm going to throw up. I don't know how to process this.
Welcome to adulthood. In the first episode of the show, your character says, I think I'm the voice of my generation, or at least a voice of a generation, which is very funny. And it's funny for that character because she's just this nobody who hasn't done anything, even written the book that she claims to be writing.
No, she shows her book to her parents and it looks to be about 4 pages long.
Exactly. It's funny in a different way, given that you're Lena Dunham, this amazing young person who's had this feature film and now has this series. And you kind of, arguably, if you want to truck in phrases like that, are a voice of your generation.
Well, I appreciate that. But, you know, I hoped that the fact that my character was on drugs when she said it would prevent people from thinking I was really trying to take the mantle on myself. But I think that I think my character, Hannah's like, okay, what's the best thing you can be? What is Joan Didion? What is Jerry Seinfeld? What do you call someone who has a lot to say about the way we all live? That would be the voice of a generation. But if you asked her, like, what are the salient features of your generation? I don't know if she'd be able to express that to you.
And she's saying this as the show begins with your character, Hannah, trying to convince her square-ish out-of-town parents to support her financially while she tries to establish herself as an artiste in New York City. But your actual parents are these successful, sophisticated New York artists. How did that upbringing, as opposed to whatever the backstory of Hannah is, make it harder and or easier to pursue the creative career you're pursuing?
I think that for the most part, it's been really beneficial, not because they've, you know, introduced me to any studio heads or whatever. You know, that's the art worlds and the film worlds are actually very separate.
But you knew what an agent was growing up.
I did. That being said, you know, I think it's amazing to see people doing what they want to do successfully every day when you're a kid and see people making money at the thing they love. You see that I understood that it was great, and I also understood that there was a lot of responsibility and a lack of stability to it. I think it made it a little harder for me to stomach the idea of, like, we also just have to support ourselves. And so when I got out of college and suddenly went, okay, I'm a restaurant hostess and there's no such thing as a mental health day, that was confusing to me. I also think that I felt a little bit like do this or bust. It was hard for me to imagine a different kind of satisfactory life. So it kind of created, in one way, this great example, and in another way, this great terror of not being able to
have the blissful, nice lives that your parents led.
And also now working, I'm doing what I love, and I'm overjoyed to have this job. But it's also given me a tremendous amount of understanding of sort of what my parents were doing all the time, because I didn't, like, my dad, I'd always go, like, well, why do you have to go to your studio if no one's telling you that you have to go to your studio? So actually understanding that, like, you are sort of in some way running a small business was a big revelation for me, and our relations have never been better.
Sure. And in college, you started making films, or cheap, I guess they're called films, they're video
productions. That's a very kind way of putting it. I made, like, little digital shorts and kind of all sorts of, like, half-formed nonsense.
You made a series called Delusional Downtown Divas that was on the web, and I guess still is on the web because the web is eternal.
Let's
let's listen to a clip from one of your
early
work, which is to say from 3 years ago.
Hi, yeah, this is Una Weingrod. I am so sorry to bug you on Labor Day, but I really need to get in touch with you. We got your phone number from Agnez's dad. Yeah.
What'd he say?
He just said the cell phone is for emergencies only, and he hung up on me.
This was an emergency.
He just hung up on me, and he's gonna think I am such a loser.
No, he's not. I'm not a loser, not all the time.
A lot of that material and your material in general mocks and satirizes the sort of world of Manhattan privilege in which you grew up.
I guess that's probably true. I mean, the first short I made, I showed to my dad, who's very supportive, and he went, I'm really glad you did this. I don't think it's great. I don't think you should show it to anybody. And I did, and I took it to a film festival, and that was a real lesson to me, which was like, this is not... The fact that my parents are creative and that I respect what they do doesn't mean that we're going to be in a constant dialogue of agreement, and that they're going to have... I think that, you know, the fact that I was putting myself on camera the way I was and asking my sister to be in my films, it tested my dad's boundaries in a way, and so...
And do you think as you go forward, you'll keep doing this in a kind of Woody Allen sense, making movies about essentially himself, starring himself, or will you suddenly, you know, go to Bali and make a movie about an elderly man?
You know, I hope that I'll do other things. I mean, I have a lot of – I always think to myself, you know, like when I'm 40, there's no way I'm going to be on camera. But it's also honestly like to be able to – I know these sound – I always used to think these were actuary cliches. But to be able to misbehave not as yourself is like a real pleasure.
Most cliches are true.
So yeah, it's true.
It's okay. Lena Dunham, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kurt. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Lena Dunham's show Girls debuts this Sunday, the night that all the cool shows air, on HBO. I spoke with Lena for a lot longer, and you can hear our entire conversation at studio360.org. Rasheed Johnson is an artist whose work deals with African-American identity in playful ways, such as his photograph entitled Self-Portrait with My Hair Parted Like Frederick Douglass. And speaking of hair, his last gallery show was devoted to the boxing promoter Don King. He started making art when he was a kid after stumbling on a painting in a museum, literally stumbling.
My name is Rasheed Johnson. I'm a visual artist. I work in photography, sculpture, painting, and film. I grew up in Evanston, which is the first northern suburb of Chicago City proper, where my mother lived, and I went to school there. I grew up going to the Art Institute of Chicago quite a bit. I often went with school groups. One of the more memorable experiences happened when I was 12 or 13. The docent was telling, you know, stories and anecdotes about the works. And me and my friends were kind of goofing around, just not really paying a tremendous amount of attention. We were like 12 or 13-year-old boys. We were in the museum. At the time, we probably considered it to be fairly boring. From what I remember, I think I had a crush on a girl who I was with and probably horsing around as a way to impress her. I happened to stumble backwards at one point, and I bumped into a large black monochrome painting. And I remember then being reprimanded by the docent and feeling very embarrassed. At that time, I decided that it was probably in my best interest to actually pay attention to what this person was saying. She went into kind of an interesting story about this large monochromatic painting. The painting was a Clifford Still painting that was painted with palette knives, so you see the paint, the black paint kind of moving around the surface. And in the corner of the painting, I believe there was a small kind of reddish crease or crack. And I remember the docent telling this story about abstract painting and how the black was this large black void of emptiness. And that this small corner was potentially like a ray of light, like some moment for optimism. What struck me about it, I think, was that there was just this black painting with this little corner, and that this woman, this docent, had kind of discovered so much more. Whether Clifford Still, and I would doubt that he would have shared the way the docent, she approached that particular painting. I think it's interesting that she had the opportunity to approach that painting that way. I've been making black monochrome works for about the last 4 years. They're made of a combination of black soap, which is a soap that is a West African product. I mix that with a bath of black wax, and I melt it into a large kind of liquid pot. And that large liquid pot is then poured onto the surface. They're these very kind of aggressive, thick, black, dense, waxy, greasy surface. I almost think of it as like a volcanic process. If you imagine when a volcano erupts and then you see the lava kind of coming down the side of the mountain and slowly it dries and you have kind of a new land formed. When I first started making the monochrome works, I did think about that experience with the Clifford Still painting that I'd bumped into at the museum. me making my own monochrome to some degree, I guess, speaks very much to that original experience. And I often, you know, have conversations with people who often, you know, feel disappointed by abstraction. People will say something as simple as, well, I could do that. That's always... But for me, there's always a second story outside of what you're seeing.
Rasheed Johnson's exhibition opens this week at Chicago's Museum of Contemporary Art. Studio 360's David Krasnow produced that story with Rebecca Lee Douglas. So what's the work of art that changed your life? Painting, pop song, play, movie, poem, whatever. Drop us a line at studio360.org and we'll get in touch. Coming up, pop quiz. Name a Nigerian writer and performer of politically conscious songs that you can dance to, other than Fela Kuti.
It's not like I listen to Fela every day. You know?
Yeah. Wait, but you lived in Nigeria. You must have.
Oh, yeah. Whitney Houston, even. Mm-hmm. Boyz II Men.
Mm-hmm. I should have mentioned Boyz II Men among your influences. NECA, the new star out of Nigeria, performs live and will also announce the winners of our fiction contest. You're listening to Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. And it is finally time to announce the winners of a contest we kicked off a few weeks ago. We asked you to write an imaginary backstory for one of three pieces of interesting junk we picked up at a thrift shop. And we got almost 300 original stories. Our contest was inspired by a book called Significant Objects, co-edited by Rob Walker, to which I happen to be a contributor. Rob helped me pick out the items, and he judged your entries, and now he is back here to tell us who the winners are. Rob, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
I noticed that a lot of people wrote about their fathers and about death. What did you make of that?
Yes, well, what I would say is that I was noticing some differences among the kinds of stories attached to each object, and in particular, the Marlboro Thermos seemed to inspire quite a number of dead fathers with pack-a-day habits.
As one might expect.
Which is interesting market research, perhaps, for the fine people of Marlboro. Actually, it made me think that maybe that's a marketplace research exercise that companies should do, is have people make up stories about their new product and see what kind of secret stories are lurking in the subconscious of people. When
wow,
they just
that's
react
that's
to
a good idea. And they could pay you millions of dollars to manage that marketing
research.
Yes,
I forgot to mention that right at the top. I should say my new business is coordinating that.
So let's start things off with this odd little doll. Which of the many scores of entries did you like the best?
I finally settled on, there were a couple I liked a lot, but I settled on Kathleen from Minneapolis. And her story is from the point of view of the doll. She made the doll a living thing.
You want to read a line or two from it?
Sure. Whatever you want to know, I'll tell you. About being old and not believing it. About losing pieces of hair and toes and God knows. But grinning back at the world anyway, one cheery red grin. I'll read one little more bit that some dolls are observers. We don't live in tiny houses and wear outfits. We stay propped, we watch, we think, and we wait for our thoughts to be read. So it's pretty evocative.
Yeah.
It's nicely done.
Very nicely done. Now, how about the wooden thing, which looked like maybe a little puzzle box? I hazarded that it was a crude cigar cutter or a trinket. We didn't know what it was, and I don't think we still know what it is. Which of its stories did you choose as the winner?
Well, another tough one, but this one I went with Peter, who I gather lives outside of Philadelphia. I like this one in part because I get a lot of comments from people in the marketing business who say, well, oh, attaching stories to objects, isn't that just what we advertisers have always done? And now when they say that to me, I'm going to send them this story and say, well, if this is what you mean, then yes.
I love this. I mean, I actually laughed out loud as I read this. You want to read some bits from the beginning, maybe?
Yes. Critics rave. Wooden Thing is a must-buy if you are a collector of such things. And since the penny's included, it's really only 99 cents, plus shipping. Barbara Blauberg of Billings, Montana gushes, I used to have a lump, but when I bought Wooden Thing, the lump disappeared and I didn't have to go to the doctor. Do you have any evidence that Wooden Thing didn't save my life?
Very nicely done, Peter. So the third winner who wrote about the Marlboro Thermos is Liz from Forestville, California. You want to read a bit of that story, Rob?
My mother was flipping through the catalog frantically in her hospital bed. I've been collecting these miles so I could finally get you something outstanding. She looked up and pulled her thinning hair behind her ear. You've always been so outdoorsy, you know. Yeah, Mom. I've got a pile of these. She pointed to a plastic bag full of carefully banded red and white coupons. Each pack is 100 miles. Wow, Mom. Well, I'm like a millionaire in this catalog, she said, sitting upright indignantly. I can order anything I like here. Pause. Do you want anything? She asked, like a child who's been caught in the wrong room. I want my mother to live long enough to come to my wedding. She tossed the catalog onto the floor, tears clogging her voice to a mumble. Low, Estelle. That was low.
And listeners can read the rest of that story themselves at studio360.org. So, Rob, how about we give Liz a call and tell her she won?
Great.
Hello?
Hi, is this Liz?
Yes, this is.
Hi, it's Kurt Anderson from Studio 360.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well. And I am here actually on the line as well with Rob Walker. And we wanted to let you know that you are one of the three winners of the Significant Object competition.
Yay, thank you.
Congratulations, Liz.
So what do you do when you're not writing stories about old thermoses?
I'm a beekeeper and a potter.
Really?
Pottery stuff makes more money.
Pottery makes more money than honey?
Yes.
So you wrote about this Marlboro Thermos that Rob and I found. Why did you choose that?
Well, for one reason, I use thermoses a lot to drink cold tea, and so I have an affection for the thermos. We spent some time in Paraguay. That's where I got my beekeeping training, and everyone there has a thermos full of cold water, so it's close to my heart.
Rob, why did you choose Liz's story from all of the ones you read about the Marlboro Thermos?
Well, for a couple of reasons. One is the kind of spareness and directness of the way it's handled. It's just a scene. Second, the introduction of the coupon books that I guess that you get if you're a frequent smoker and you get, you know, free prizes, which may well be where this object came from. But the introduction of one of those kind of catalogs into the scene was so sort of inappropriately funny. So it was walking this really interesting line between being very grave and very sort of disturbing, but also kind of absurd.
So now that you've won the Marlboro Thermos, what do you think you'll do with it?
I think I'll take it to a bee job and drink some water.
That sounds like a good home for it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thanks to everybody who wrote stories for our contest. You can read the three winning stories as well as all of the other submissions at studio360.org. Rob Walker's book, Significant Objects, is out this summer. It's rare that a musician comes along whose songs are political and great world music and globally appealing pop. Somebody like Bob Marley. Well, we just might have found that singer-songwriter for this moment. NECA. As you did touch on me so, as you did break my heart, as you did do the thing we could do me, did do me, as you did rip my bragged and dignity away. They make me suffer. So they make me suffer. You never tell me say you know what you. She grew up in Nigeria, and then when she got older, spent some time in Germany, her mother's home country. Her music is a mixture of Afrobeat, hip-hop, R&B, folk pop, and she has just released her second album in the U.S. called Soul is Heavy, and she is here right now in our studio. NECA, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much.
You've said, I've read, that moving from Nigeria to Germany in the 1990s changed how you saw yourself and how you saw Nigeria. How so?
Well, I never really, how do I put it? I never really considered myself, I didn't put myself in a place of nationality. Like, I am Nigerian or I am German, you know. I'm a mixed person. And I knew that, okay, if I'm traveling to Germany, obviously, I couldn't speak the language, okay?
Yeah,
number two, I don't look like a German. And number three, I didn't know anybody, you know. So I was a foreigner. And I was treated like a foreigner, despite the fact that I have both passports. Even if you on your passport is written Deutsch, that does not necessarily mean that you are German in Germany.
I can imagine.
So, well, I had to make my experience, you know. I had to go through certain things. And it was not just all negative, you know. I did have positive encounters with, you know, really inspiring people, people who also helped me out. So, well, I began to appreciate being Nigerian by stepping away from Nigeria.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
When you began singing, was it just a kind of natural mashup of what you'd grown up listening to?
I would listen to other people. I would listen to Fela, or I would listen to the Fugees, or Victor Wifo, and Bob Marley as well. You know, I love Bob Marley. Whitney Houston, even. Mm-hmm. Boyz II Men.
Mm-hmm. I should have mentioned Boyz II Men among your influences.
It started with rap, actually, because I would always intermingle with men. I was always kind of a tomboy. And I always wanted to be somehow. I wanted to be a man, you know, somewhere, somehow, honestly. so I would always compete.
And rap was
compete.
A very male thing.
Yeah, it was a male thing. Because I always had to compete with that. So I would rap, and nobody really wanted to acknowledge or recognize my rap. And then eventually I blended, you know, I decided to do both for my own record, rap and sing. And I stayed myself. I didn't want to sound like anybody. Just be me.
Well, let's hear you sing, and let's hear you yourself. You're going to sing a song called My Home?
Yes.
Down. You were my hope, oh love.
my middle, my end. Where do I go when they leave me? Who do I turn to when my world is dark? Oh, you're my refuge. Hey, hey. I run to you.
That was NECA performing an acoustic version, singing and on guitar, of My Home, live in Studio 360, joined by Clef on guitar as well. Well, that's a heartbreaking song.
Mm.
What home are you singing about in My Home?
I'm singing about the God within my music, where I find seek refuge, I personally. And of course, taking it to a next level, despite all the negativity, people still find the courage and the perseverance to be. And, you know, regardless of the turmoil, still appreciate life. It is also about the plight of Africa, how much pain we have to undergo. Or better to say, Africa as woman, mother, has to undergo because of our selfish behavior, the selfishness of our corrupt political leaders, the selfishness of Western countries that come and exploit Africa. I'm not just putting the blame on, you know, our colonial forefathers.
Right.
As at now, we are an
50 years later, you have to sort of take your own...
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, we have tribal wars, we have religious conflicts, but, you know, gradually, Nigerians are also beginning to take responsibility for themselves, as in the inhabitants, not the political leaders. Occupy Nigeria, which is a big event, as in I myself have never experienced anything as such in my lifetime.
Really? Which is of course the source of it, a few blocks away from here. Occupy Wall Street then became a movement in Nigeria.
Exactly. So people coming together regardless of their backgrounds, their tribes, you have Yoruba, Igbo, Hausa come together to speak their minds. And people are frustrated by living, they're frustrated by keeping silent, you know. We do not want to live that way anymore. And you can see that agitation in the eyes and the actions of the people. So I do believe Occupy Nigeria, the Occupy Nigeria movement has motivated many to speak out their minds and also be involved politically, raise their voices and participate in elections.
So it sounds like you're, for all of your sadness and critique, you're hopeful, maybe.
I am hopeful because I contribute to solutions.
There you go. Neka, thank you so much for taking time out from your tour to come in here and sing and talk.
Thank you very much for having me and for all the support. Okay, our next song is called Shining Star.
In this madness, in this world, with its swiftness and its coldness, you're my peace of mind. When the world just keeps turning and I know not where to head to, you're my peace of mind, oh Lord. And when I look up in the skies and see all that you created, nothing else does count but your everlasting love, oh Lord.
On our website, studio360.org, there's yet another song from Neka's performance, as well as a video of her playing here.
Hey. Beautiful star, do keep your eyes on me. Oh,
and that's it for today's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you listen again next time. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Max Bernstein,
Rebecca Lee Douglas,
Thomas Seeley,
Krista Ripple.
Thanks also to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, Wayne Coyne. For years, the leader of the Flaming Lips worked in a fast food restaurant in Oklahoma City.
I was robbed at gunpoint, laid on the floor with a gun to our heads. To me, it occurred to me for the first time that I was actually alive.
The Flaming Lips' Wayne Coyne. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.